Hey everyone, and welcome to the best of 2025 episode on the Future of HR podcast. Before we get to who you can expect to learn from in this episode, I want to take a moment to highlight what an incredible year 2025 was for the podcast and for me personally. We had over 100,000 downloads for the second year in a row, which is truly amazing. I could not have done this without you, so thank you so much for listening, telling your friends, your coworkers about the podcast. It means so much. We continue to get world-class CHROs and HR thought leaders as guests who are aligned with my mission of elevating our function and developing next-gen HR leaders. I want to thank all my guests for sharing their insights with us and being part of the podcast. We all learn so much from you each and every week. And what I'm most proud about is that I continue to get emails from you that say the podcast is helping you to have more impact in your role and accelerate your career. Please keep those emails coming. I love to hear from you, and your support keeps me going each and every week. 2025 was also an incredible year for me personally and professionally. Since launching the podcast and going out on my own, I often get asked to speak at HR conferences for Fortune 500 companies. And this year was no different, as I had 9 in-person speaking engagements at HR conferences and 5 virtual workshops and keynotes. I love speaking to HR teams and look forward to doing more in 2026. I also had the opportunity to do consulting with some amazing organizations this year, with engagements that range from helping HR leadership teams develop business-focused HR strategies, becoming even more effective and high-performing teams, or elevating their talent practices and systems. I also had the opportunity to develop custom HR capability programs for several Fortune 500 companies designed to help their HR business partners build their influence, impact, and business acumen. If you're looking to do the same in 2026, I'd love to talk. We had 2 NextGen HR Accelerator cohorts this year, and now we're over 125 people who've been through the program, which is just incredible. Seeing these NextGen HR leaders develop and grow has been one of the highlights of the year. I also had the honor of joining the University of Michigan's Ross School for Business Advanced HR Executive Program as an executive education faculty member, and I've taught multiple cohorts in 2025 and looking forward to doing more in 2026. I hosted several Future of HR webinars this year, which had incredible turnout, and you can look forward to me doing more webinars in 2026 that'll hopefully elevate your impact and give back to the function. And I launched my Future of HR newsletter, which is now over 3,000 subscribers. And if you're a next-gen HR leader and you like the pod, then this is the newsletter for you. Go to futureofhr.com to subscribe. And last but not least, I was able to take a 2-week vacation with my family to Greece. This was one of the first extended vacations I've ever had in my career. I know, a little bit late, but it is something I plan to do again this year as well. As you can tell, 2025 was a year to remember, and I'm so grateful for everything that the podcast and this community has given me. Thank you for listening to the podcast. Thanks to my clients, those who've trusted me to speak at your organizations, consult with you, or be part of your extended team. Thank you very much. With that, let's get to the best of 2025 episode. Now, as you can imagine, selecting the best episodes and moments for 2025 was almost next to impossible. We had so many amazing guests that in the end, I had to make some tough judgment calls. I looked at total downloads. I reflected on the episodes where I received lots of emails or comments on LinkedIn. And while I tried to be objective, I also wanted to be sure that this episode represented the amazing mix of talent and thought leadership we had on the podcast in 2025. So who can you expect to hear from today? Monique Herrera, Wanda Wallace and Darren Overfield, Rena Hellstrom, Dave Ulrich, Marsha Avedon, Lisa Chang, Christina Norris Watts, Anita Graham, Christy Pambianchi, Ani Wong and Anthony Nyberg, Brandon Samut, Tina Gupta, Brian Miller, Jennifer Wilson, and Brad Warga. And first up is the incredible Monique Herrera, Chief Colleague Experience Officer at American Express. And in episode 126, Boldly Leading Change, Monique shares how she's focused on building enterprise leaders at Amex and breaking down silos, a masterclass that we can all learn from. Because leaders are the ones that day-to-day bring the Amex culture to life.
and breaking down silos. And a lot of companies really struggle with this. Maybe talk a little more about your approach to building enterprise leaders and really creating this amazing culture at Amex.
I'm glad you hit on that. Critical part of our framework for winning is these leadership behaviors that I mentioned. One of the things we wanted to do in HR, the colleague experience group, as we talked about, is where are we starting really? We've always been known for growing great leaders at American Express, but we can't get comfortable. Speaking of staying curious and focusing on continuous improvement, like how do we ensure that we are building the right leaders against all of our behaviors, one of them being an enterprise leader? That's actually one of our behaviors, and leaders who really live out our blue box values at every level. And honestly, we also think individual contributors really are leading as well from what their role is day in, day out, and the impact they have across the company. So maybe you're a people leader, maybe you're an individual contributor, but how you work on a team, how you work across the company, across borders, across functions, across businesses, how you get things done, how you represent our brand, et cetera, how you interact with customers, that's all enterprise leadership. So we're really focused at growing great leaders at every level. We've really tried to shift to a more consumer-grade experience for our colleagues so they can get the learning when and where they need it, because we really want to make sure that we are developing leaders at every stage who are authentic, who are courageous, and continue to have an environment where they can feel comfortable to innovate. We've been around 175 years. So it's really important to us that we continue to have this environment where people can push and debate ideas and bring forth new ideas. So from a very early stage, we really want to make sure that those guiding principles are set forth. We have this great program. We have a number of programs and products that we roll out that are really holistic. One of them is called Leadership at Amex, and it's a whole suite of resources and learning opportunities that help all of our colleagues strengthen their leadership skills. We, like every other company, hopefully large company, we move a lot of people around internally. We've gotten much better at doing that. We infuse new talent externally where we need to. We're great at onboarding people. We call it new to blue. We really want to make sure that people are growing for the long term at Amex.
Next in episode 127, Rethinking How Top Teams Work, Wanda Wallace, Managing Partner of Leadership Forum, and Darren Overfield, EVP, Coaching and Consulting at Kaiser Leadership Solutions, challenge the conventional wisdom on what it takes to build an effective top team. In this clip, you'll hear them explain what we're getting wrong in this important topic and how to actually make leadership teams work.
And so, Wanda, I want to start with you a little bit. When we talk about top team effectiveness, there's just a ton of conventional wisdom that we kind of take for granted, right? You have to have psychological safety, consensus on goals, deep levels of trust. Yet you and Darren have recently begun to rethink and challenge some of these conventional wisdoms, which I think is awesome. So tell us more about what you're challenging and what you're finding. Maybe we could have wrong on this important topic of running effective teams.
All right. So let me paint a picture of what I think we all believe a top team, so a top management team, CEO and direct reports, should be like. We would say they should all get along. They might be different personalities, but they should get along. They should be nice, respectful to each other. They should have a shared set of values that are consistent with the corporate values. They should have their enterprise hat on. We should have some sense of the greater good. Yes, there's a hierarchy in that the CEO is there so that we give the CEO some power, but we expect that team to operate in a non-hierarchical way. And that means that everybody has equal say and everybody has equal power. And that, yes, it's not a pure consensus because we don't have time for that, but it needs to feel more consensus-like than not. And we shouldn't be competing with each other. We're all in the same enterprise together for the same greater good at the end of the day, and off we go. And that anything, you said psychological safety, that we should feel free to say whatever is our own mind, there are no consequences, that we should have healthy debate, and that there should be deep levels of trust. In effect, we kind of operate like your image of the Knights of the Round Table, all sitting around having a wonderful, healthy debate about what might or might not happen, and maybe somebody eventually weighing in and saying, okay, we're going to go in this direction or not. The problem is, it doesn't seem to work that way. in practice, because people don't have equal power sitting around that table, leaving the CEO out. Some people have higher revenue shares than others. That gives them more power. Some people have longevity. That gives them more power. What the greater good is, if I steal a page from Adam Kahane, is really dependent on where you're sitting in the organization. So there's a lot to question. And we all know consensus really doesn't work at the end of the day. And anybody who's tried to build trust in a top team knows that it's easy to say and really difficult to do. So we've been questioning that mythology.
In episode 128, The Art and Science of Agile HR, Rena Hellstrom, founder of Agile HR Community, stops by to talk about the product mindset and the critical shift HR leaders have to make. This was one of those conversations that really got people thinking differently about how we design and deliver HR. And I think you'll find Rena's energy and insights are contagious.
What I think about for HR leaders, they've got to adopt these new ways of thinking and new ways of working. What does this mean for HR? What is this big change on thinking and acting differently from your perspective, Rena?
If you want to start moving towards this as a HR leader, it is moving towards a more product mindset in HR. Instead of thinking about massive projects or massive streams of work, we can start thinking about features and releases of our HR products. So for example, I was working with one global HR team. They're leading an organization of 45,000 people, and we need to move into a quarterly planning from an annual planning cycle. And the biggest difficulty for these leaders is to start chunking down these elephant projects into attainable, deliverable parts. They come into prioritization with themes such as management development or people experience. And I'm trying to shake them up, wake them up to say, this isn't a deliverable. Okay, people experience is a theme. What are you going to deliver under people experience during the next quarter? What is the outcome of that? And how can you see that you've actually succeeded? And HR teams are not used to this kind of conversation. And when we start facilitating this, they're starting to understand that, wow, okay, we have to be more deliberate in what we're building, in what the outcome is, and then also understand the capacity in our HR teams. Can we build all of these things? And prioritization is where it usually... So I tend to say, for going towards an agile HR operating model and agile HR ways of working in HR teams, the biggest blocker are HR leaders themselves.
Next up is the one and only Dave Ulrich in episode 131, Up Close and Personal with Dave Ulrich. And in this conversation, we go deep on what the young Dave was really like and the early experiences that shaped his perspectives on life, leadership, and organizations. This was a special episode and one you will not want to miss. You are considered the father of modern HR, but I'm curious, what was young Dave Ulrich like? What early experiences shaped your perspectives on life, leadership, and organizations?
It's fun to go back and try to figure out what drove what, and I don't know for sure. Obviously, parents. I had two parents who were very good. My dad believed I should work. When I was 13, we knew a guy who owned a gas station where I lived. My dad went to him and said, I will pay Dave's salary. You hire him to go work in your gas station at 13. So I worked in the gas station. And then my dad said, that's not enough. You need to learn to work. I put up little ads everywhere. I'll do yard work. I still remember decades ago, I was 14 or 15, doing yard work that probably you did when you were young, mowing a lawn, pulling weeds. And it was a big house where we lived. And I looked in the window and there was some kid my age watching me. And I thought, this doesn't seem right. But in the end, that's a passion. You work, you care, you give back. My mom cooked more casseroles for people in need in the neighborhood than any human being in the world. I got one other story about my dad since you opened that window. He worked for the government, built campgrounds for a large part time, then worked for a group called Job Corps in the 60s and 70s, which was a social agency. Then he retired pretty early. And he decided that the commitment to service was real. So he would go to stores and take their day old food, the fruit, the bread that's still good, and give it to shelters around the city. And he called it his bread run. So for 25 years, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, Dad did a bread run. And every time I'd go visit, he'd say, Dave, we're going to go do the bread run. I go, oh, here we go again. But I learned by example, not by word. You go, when he died, no, I'm going to get emotional. I hadn't planned that. Thank you for really pulling out some old memories. The hall where we held the service was full to the rafters with people who got food from my dad doing his daily bread run. I find that's kind of an interesting message to say, you give back without fanfare. This wasn't a big fanfare, wasn't a big deal, but we hauled day-old food into all kinds of shelters and places that people needed it. And I think Dad led by example. I hope I do that also with those I work with.
In episode 132, How to Become a Board-Ready CHRO, Marsha Avedon, a three-time CHRO and board of director, shares her advice to CHROs who aspire to earn a seat on a board. And in this clip, she outlines how new CHROs can onboard for success in their first 90 days. Marsha's the real deal, and if you're thinking about your next chapter or you want to understand what it takes to earn a seat on a board, this is a must-listen conversation.
Marsha, thinking about like a new CHRO and that transition period, first 90 days to 6 months, are there a few things you say just you really have to do to land well with that new executive team and CEO?
Yeah, I would say there's two things in the first 100 days or whatever. The first is a continuation of the discussion about capabilities within the function, which is really assessing, do you have the A team that you need? What changes do you need to make? And then secondly, really to assess honestly your relationships that are critical stakeholder relationships. What's the relationship with the CEO first and foremost? If you're from the outside, you're building a new relationship. If you're from the inside, you're now establishing yourself as a true advisor confidant to that CEO. But also the relationships with the board, because most of the time, new CHROs who haven't been a CHRO elsewhere haven't really had to build the relationships with the board. And so assessing what's the strength of those relationships, who do you know on the board, how well do you know them? Of course, the compensation committee chair is a critical player, but usually either the board chair or the lead director is a critical relationship. And then I actually have my folks do an assessment of the executive leadership team and really honestly assess what's the strength of each relationship on that ELT, and then which ones matter the most. So if you're going to prioritize where you're going to make investments and nurture those relationships, which ones matter the most to your success? Very deliberately, we kind of go through that. I normally do a 360 too, so I get not only their own view, but I get others' views as well. And they take all that. And in the first 90 days, they have a plan about how are they going to build those relationships, both at the board level with the executive team and or with their own team. I have one case where the person was promoted from within. They were all her peers, and some of them were not happy about her getting the job. And so in 90 days, you have to realize, are they going to get over it and get on board or not, right? So all of those relationship kinds of things, I think, are really critical in the first 100 days.
Next is Lisa Chang, Chief People Officer at the Coca-Cola Company, who joined us for episode 134, Building a Fit for Purpose Company. Lisa shares why she believes Chief People Officer roles will change in the future and how she sees the CPO role evolving. Her perspective on what's coming next for a profession is both thoughtful and provocative.
You're also saying not just the future of HR, of course, the roles are going to change, but Chief People Officer's roles might change in the future. And how are you thinking and seeing the role of the senior HR leaders shifting in the future?
I think even in the last decade, the role of the CHRO has changed, again, from one of orchestrating a whole bunch of processes into one that has become an integral part of whatever it's the two in the box, three in the box, four in the box, key people making decisions and setting strategy for the company. They don't want to talk about what's the latest benefit plan and how's it working. They assume that that's happening. They want to know, okay, what are we not thinking about that we should be thinking about? What's hiding around the corner? What's our competition doing to recruit people with skills that they're so much faster to market than we are? How are they doing this so fast and their marketing is so appealing? And what are the things that they're doing that we're not doing? And how are we preparing the pipeline of talent? How are we preserving the institutional knowledge we need to ensure that we build continuity while at the same time challenging people to think about things they'd never thought about. So all of this, I think, is the role of the CPO these days, which is sitting there helping the organization understand how to navigate. And rarely do I go into the meetings with answers, policies, and programs that just kind of say, well, if we just do this, it's going to fix everything. So usually it is a very contentious and back and forth conversation about, do we hire the people or do we train our people? Do we build the skills or do we buy the skills? It's a dynamic conversation that happens with the team about what's the best way to get where we need to go. And most of the time, we're trying to reduce the number of things we're doing, not add. And so then it becomes one of prioritization and focus. Well, I often say to the team, look, I could do 65 HR programs for you, but only two are going to really move the needle. So let's prioritize and decide which two we're really going to do. And for us, it's really about building future capabilities and making sure that our people have the skills, the resources, and the time to develop themselves, because we can't do it fast enough for everybody that needs to be developed. Those are the types of conversations that I think we're having. So what it requires in our organization and many others is a structure where a lot of the operational aspects of HR are now handled in a part of the organization where operational effectiveness, efficiency, technology, and other things are allowing us to do those with great speed and efficiency and cost saving, as opposed to hordes of people sitting around key punching, which is what it used to be.
In episode 135, Skills-Based Learning, How J&J Puts People First, Christina Norris Watts, head of assessment and people practices at Johnson & Johnson, gives us an honest take on transitioning to a skills-based organization. She says it's like eating your Brussels sprouts, and in this clip, she explains why. This episode really resonated with HR leaders who are in the middle of implementing skills-based initiatives.
As you said, that this transition to a skills-based organization is like eating your Brussels sprouts. And so I see this already going to be on t-shirts, but truly, this is so funny. You say skills-based organizations is like eating your Brussels sprouts. So tell us more why you say this.
So somewhere between the 1980s and now, Brussels sprouts got a new marketing manager, right? Because when I was a kid, no one was talking about Brussels sprouts. You were forced to eat them. Now, if you go to a restaurant, it's very common that Brussels sprouts will be there as an appetizer, and they will be charred, and they will be in a balsamic glaze, and they will have bacon or prosciutto, and you will get them as an appetizer to split with the table. Imagine doing that 30 years ago. That's unfathomable. Similarly, skills. So if you're old enough to remember KSAOs, when we used to do job analysis and define a job, we'd say what tasks are needed on the jobs and what are the knowledge, skills, abilities, and other characteristics that are needed to perform that job. And IO psychologists would come in and they would say, you should do this job analysis and you should figure this out so that you can really, really need it on the job. And we have been saying that for decades and decades and decades. And people didn't want to do it. They really didn't want to eat the Brussels sprouts. They're like, that seems like a lot of work. And oh, by the way, as soon as you do it, it's out of date. Like, it takes you so long to measure the job and then it's out of date. Or you measure the job and then you give me this huge spreadsheet of 500 skills per job, KSAOs, excuse me, per job. And what am I supposed to do with it? And as a consultant, I face that. You probably face similar things. So it was tricky. It was out of date immediately. And it was very tricky to figure out the overlap between jobs and the intersection between jobs. And how are we doing with that? Well, technology has advanced and it has helped us, and it's helped us do this faster, and it has helped us give good UI tools for users to use it, meaning like the actual person in the job to understand it, the managers of the job to understand it, the HR business partner to understand it. The technology has advanced so much that we're able to now use this data in a faster, more effective way than we were ever able to use it before. And so now we have business leaders in our organization coming to us saying, hey, I think we should really figure out the skills needed for success in the job. I heard this really good podcast the other week, and we need to figure out the skills needed for success in the job and then hire people based on that, or make sure we're training people based on that, or make sure people are aware of the skills there. And it frustrates me when my colleagues in IO Psych
hear that and say, we've been telling you that for 30 years. Why didn't you listen to us before? And I'm like, no, that's not the answer. The answer is, what a great idea. And thank goodness I have the skills and experience to do that for you. I know how to do that for you. You want to spend $1 million figuring out the skills for your job? That's brilliant. I love to hear it. I'm ready to go. Yes, some of these technology organizations have taken the Brussels sprout, they've charred them, they put balsamic glaze on it, and suddenly these people want it in a way they didn't want it before when we were just selling boiled Brussels sprouts. They want it now. You say, yes, yes, we're ready to go. We know how to do this, and we do agree this is the right thing to do.
Next up is Anita Graham, CHRO for LabCorp, who in episode 145, The People P&L, How HR Drives Business Success, introduces us to the concept of a people P&L. And when it comes to building a high-performing HR function, Anita shares the metrics and indicators she uses to measure her team's effectiveness and impact. And trust me, you'll want to take notes on this one. Thinking about high-performing HR functions, what metrics do you believe CHROs or business leaders are looking at and kind of saying, hey, what really matters when you think about this? What does that look like from a metric standpoint? How do you judge that we're doing a good job?
There are clearly the metrics that all business leaders will look for their businesses. So that's going to include your core metrics about talent, talent retention, hiring rates, mobility, termination rates, differences by population type, understanding the things that impact the P&L in the business from a talent standpoint. Those are metrics that are critical to be able to know and understand the drivers of those metrics. And you can lean into a business challenge pretty easily having those metrics. From there, you really start to build on to, I would say, higher level, higher order metrics, which really drive your more strategic long-term outcomes around the business. So there's some typical things that I like to look at that's around talent outcomes that are business aligned. So do we have the leadership bench strength? What is our internal mobility rate? What does retention for high potentials look like? What do your leadership pipelines look like? Those are the next order of things. We're starting to look at engagement, and it's not just engagement for the sake of engagement. There's the ENPS, the Employee Net Promoter Score. That's something I've looked at for many years, and I think you can tie it back to business outcomes very easily. So looking at things that help to build a workforce that cares about what they do, that understands what they do to serve the customer, that feels supported, that feels that managers, you know, care about them, that workforce will be much more dynamic in the sense of being willing and able to change, to drive change, to take on new initiatives, to care about what's happening with the customer and innovate around that. And you have to start to tell these stories with the data. We have a wonderful state of talent set of slides that we're producing now, sort of refined them. We're producing quarterly, but the next level of that, it's like, oh, let's not just look at the data. It's the storytelling with the data that we need to do. And that's what one of the skills that we're looking to make sure our leaders, our HR business partners are equipped with. So they actually proactively can bring something that I hope evolves into what I call a people P&L. It's the key metrics that actually each leader should care about as much as they care about their financial P&L, because they know that if those metrics are trending in the right direction, their financial P&L is going to trend in the right direction.
In episode 149, Future of HR, How AI Can Unlock HR's Potential, Christy Pambianchi, CHRO at Caterpillar Inc., helps us understand how AI is becoming a disruptive force in how we work and live. And in this clip, she shares how she sees AI specifically transforming the world of work and the HR function. Christy's practical wisdom and her optimistic mindset on AI really shines through in this episode. And you've also said AI is a disruptive force, which we think we all really agree with in terms of how we work and live. How do you specifically see that transforming the world of work and the HR function?
I've always been someone that loved technology, in full disclosure, JP. So I lived in a town that was near some tech companies. So in the 80s, they put computers in my grade school and middle school. I learned to code when I was 11 years old, back in BASIC. Nobody probably even knows that anymore. I've just constantly, whether it was in college or my internships or my jobs, my time as CHRO, really leaned into tech. And so now as I think about AI, I mean, I think it's amazing. And I think that it has the possibility to augment all of us. It's like we can have a work buddy that is helping us with tasks all day, helping offload some of the basic things that we might have spent a lot of time doing, and really allow us to find the time to do new things, new levels of analytics, new levels of insights, new levels of contribution. I was actually at a recent visit with employees in one of our locations, and they were saying, we want to use more AI tools in our jobs. And so employees are clamoring for this. And I was talking to shift workers. I was talking in multiple countries. I'm excited about that because I think this is a technology that should be crowdsourced about all the ways that it could be innovative and powerful. And I think that this is not the kind of tool where leaders are going to sit around a conference table in a C-suite and come up with the solution. So the best thing we can do is create the framework for intellectual property to be protected and have the safety and all the other pieces of the tool or tool set that your company decides to use, decide it. That's a good role for leadership. But then release the tool to the masses and see what they do with it, because they're the experts in those jobs. Back to that right side up company, like a frontline employee, somebody in accounting, somebody in my HR Global Service Center, somebody in sales, they know their job better than anyone else. And if we give them a set of AI tools, they could probably figure out how can those tools make them better in their job and also drive the advancement of the company. And so I like to say, how can AI help me out-invent my competitor? How can it help me do product development faster than the next guy? How can it help my operations have less break shrink or have less loss or be more efficient and effective than the competition? How can my sales team have more information at the ready about the customer set and have more customized solutions? So these are the ways I think about AI. And I think it is a little bit of a shame, JP, that the first sort of quarter in that big Q2 of 2023, when AI really exploded, some of the first narrative was it's going to wipe out jobs, it's going to replace X percent of the workforce, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's always what the narrative is with the new technology. And I just kind of look at it from the opposite lens of, no, it's going to actually take routine tasks, get them done at the fingertips of employees and talent, and it's going to give them the space to think of all these other amazing differentiating things that can make our companies win.
Next is episode 153, How to Avoid the 10 Pitfalls of CEO Succession, featuring Ani Wong, Senior Executive Vice President of the CHRO Association, and Anthony Nyberg, Director of the Center for Executive Succession at University of South Carolina. One central finding of their research is that the CHRO is essential to CEO succession, but only if they're trusted. In this clip, they explain how a CHRO actually builds that level of trust with both the board and the sitting CEO when succession planning inherently creates tension. You did survey dozens of board of directors, and you found that in CEO succession, this surprised me a little bit, CHROs are often more critical than the CEO in shaping the actual outcome. That's a bold finding. Tell us what led to that conclusion.
It was really the directors talking about the importance of the CHRO in this process. And to really highlight, the directors share with us that when they have a great CHRO, a leader, Kevin Cox out there that I just tried to tease, that person really makes all of the difference in terms of driving a great succession process. And those directors are really talking about helping define the process, helping really shape the criteria that will be useful for the incoming or the next CEO, and really helping objectively evaluate those candidates.
It makes sense that the CHRO can play such a big role. But you also, Ani, you found that this really only works if the CHRO is actually trusted. What's that look like?
That was a super fascinating finding in this research. There were definitely two tracks of director feedback. If the CHRO is a trusted CHRO with both the board and the CEO, then the directors responded that an engaged CHRO is incredibly important to the process, and that on the boards where they felt like they had the best succession processes in place, they always had an engaged CHRO. But if there wasn't a pre-existing relationship of trust with the CHRO for whatever reason, maybe they're new, maybe there were issues that had happened in the past, then it was the opposite. The same behaviors that we recommended in our guide could actually backfire on a CHRO. They were perceived totally differently by the board. So instead of the CHRO being engaged and trying to broaden the board's perspective, which is how they felt with a trusted CHRO, they might actually feel that the CHRO has an agenda that they're trying to put forward if they lack that trust. So the very same actions could be perceived totally differently by the board. I wasn't expecting that.
Just to keep building on that, because these first two things you raise are really closely linked, right? It's the directors. The reason why the CHRO is considered so valuable is that the directors are really looking for that objective information and a way to really trust the process that's going on. And there can be times when the CEO may have their own agendas, whether that's just about the current management of the organization, or they want to stay in place, or they're not putting in enough time in terms of those potential new CEOs or the future CEOs. And the board needs someone that's going to help drive that process and that they can rely on to be an objective source of knowledge, which is where the CHRO's role of coming in terms of helping develop talent and drive the process. And of course, exactly as Ani just said, that requires a great deal of trust between the CHRO and the board. And to help in many of these processes, the trust between that CHRO and the CEO.
Next is Brandon Samet, Chief People and AI Transformation Officer at Zapier, who at episode 156, How to Build an AI-First People Team, shares how Zapier's made AI fluency non-negotiable for every team member. In this conversation, Brandon explains why leadership realized this was necessary and the decision-making processes behind it. If you're thinking about AI strategy for your organization, this is a must listen. So Zapier's made an AI fluency a non-negotiable for every team member. And I want to hear more about this. There's an AI fluency framework we'll talk about next. But just talk more about, when did leadership realize that this was necessary and what was the decision-making process behind it?
Knowing what I know now, I think we should have done this sooner. Here's what I mean by that. Zapier's AI transformation journey started almost 2.5 years ago, so earlier than many organizations, and not because Zapier was prescient or because we had to. Zapier's whole mission is around helping folks abstract tedium by being able to write software and automate work without having to code. And then in the spring of 2023, this is about 6 months after ChatGPT 3.5 comes out, and we're seeing, because we're using it pretty robustly within the organization at that time, that this is going to meaningfully influence how we help our customers actually deliver on that promise of helping people be unusually impactful and also making jobs more interesting by abstracting the tedium. And we wanted to get on top of it. Like a whole, we could see in the distance a massive wave of opportunity on the horizon. But the reality check was, just like any big wave, you can find a way to ride that wave to even greater success and like really make a bigger difference in the world. But that same wave, if you're not paying attention, can also crush you as an organization. And that's kind of the sensation we had as we got into spring of 2023. We declared a AI code red at that time, just really calling the whole organization into building and experimenting with AI, because that's what our customers are doing. And increasingly, they're looking to Zapier, even all the way back then, over 2.5 years ago, for guidance and then a product that would be able to go with them on their journey as well. So say, well, we need to be our own best exemplar of this journey so we can be credible and useful to our customers. So that was a call to action. But it wasn't until 2 years later, so call it spring of this year, we had been doing all this skill building and use case development with AI inside the organization. And about 100 days ago, we were like, goodness, at the end of the day, like, we're not necessarily explicitly screening for AI fluency for all the people we're adding to the company. We had been doing it for very specific roles for years, but not broadly. I think it's time. I think we really understand like what enables someone to be successful in this organization, which is reinventing itself with AI at the core. So let's translate what we've learned into effectively a screen for 100% of candidates and for 100% of jobs in the organization. And that's how it works today. You apply to a job at Zapier, doesn't matter what it is, what job level or function, we'll be talking with you about the extent to which you're using AI and how you're using it and why you're using it, the way you're using it, and just learning alongside you. And we've also open sourced the rubric that we use to evaluate candidates. Again, like Zapier, one Zapier has a value called default to transparency, right? So this is one way that we reflect that.
In episode 162, New York Life's AI Blueprint, Tina Gupta, SVP of Talent Management at New York Life Insurance, talks about Ignite AI, their ambitious initiative to turn 12,000 employees into 12,000 AI innovators. Tina shares what the team has achieved with Ignite AI and some early successes, like 7,500 GPTs, and the key learnings that will help anyone who's thinking about scaling AI across their organization. Now let's talk about AI, because we're excited, and I'm sure people are like, JP, you promised me that Tina is going to tell me about AI and what's happening in New York Life. So you got an initiative, you call it Ignite AI, and you're really trying to turn 12,000 employees into 12,000 innovators who are AI fluent.
I think as with any other company, we started our AI journey with a little bit of dabbling, a little bit of experimentation. We had a few use cases. But I think what we quickly realized at that point was, A, without strong facilitation and hands-on guidance, the teams who were enabling those use cases, they liked to do that work. And then they were like, oh, that was really good. Okay, I'm going back to my day job. This concept of like, they will build it and they will come. If you build it, they will come, didn't really play out in our early observations of rolling out AI tools. At the same time, we've been on a massive tech transformation as an organization for many years. And we realize that AI is potentially our opportunity to leapfrog some of those steps that we've been taking to just incrementally improve some of our technology. And actually, let's just go to the end state and miss steps A, B, and C and start at G or wherever it may be. So there was a commitment from the organization to lean more and more into AI as a enabler and productivity driver for our work. So every employee has ChatGPT and Copilot. As we were rolling out these tools, again, we were recognizing that the adoption rates just weren't there. A group of us quickly came together, and this group is co-led by myself and my partner in crime in our AI&D team. That's Don Vu, who's our head of AI at New York Life. And we got our teams together with a few other folks, including we have our people in governance and comms and so on. And we quickly strategized and said, this is actually not just about rolling out the tools, but it's also about enabling them. It's about making sure people are aware of what's happening. But core to our strategy is actually, let's build excitement of AI. Let's make this really fun and interesting and engaging versus what we were hearing on the ground, which is, I'm a little bit nervous. I'm not sure I should use it. Is it going to take my job away? How's it going to disrupt what I do? We're like, no, this is all great. This is going to make your life easier and better and enhance what we're doing. So the Ignite AI strategy has three pillars. It's mindset, skill set, and tool set. Within each, we've spent a significant amount of time really diving deep on how we bring those pieces to life. But we really deliberately started with mindset, because this ultimately is a change management strategy. This is not a technology rollout. We tried that. It wasn't successful. And so we've pivoted to this becoming a learning and change and comms experience. We had a 90-day sprint that we laid out. The first 30 days was all about getting used to the tool. We were really talking about being, how do you solve problems differently? How do you get used to using ChatGPT day to day, or what can Copilot do for you? So we had some like really fun prompts, and we did challenges. And so we had people engaging just at the most baseline. We then went into like, that was really our mindset. The skill set and tool set followed. Within those 90 days, what we actually experienced was we had around 15,000 hours of learning take place in this condensed period of time. So some of that was around, feel free to come and join, and some of it was mandatory. So we had, here are the two things that we really want you to do. One was responsible AI usage, and one was much more about what are some of the basics around mindset and thinking differently about using AI. We've had 7,500 GPTs and agents built across the organization in that period of time.
Next up is Brian Miller, Chief Talent and D&I Officer at Levi Strauss & Company, who joined us for episode 166, Belonging by Design, The New Equation for Performance. Brian explains belonging by design work they're doing at Levi's and what made him realize that traditional engagement surveys weren't getting to the heart of what really drives performance. This conversation will change how you think about creating environments where people can do their best work. Now, you're also doing some really cool work at Levi's, and you talk about as belonging by design, this belonging by design work. Tell us more about kind of what made you realize that traditional engagement surveys weren't really getting to the heart of what drives performance, and that's why you're thinking about this as belonging by design.
It's another phrase that we've anchored into Levi's as well, belonging by design. So let's reel it back a little bit and talk about engagement surveys. Let's start with that one. So engagement surveys usually tell you how people feel, not what really matters, was the anchor I was going for. So I saw an opportunity to really go back to first principles, something else I'll probably come back to, this idea of first principles really matter. So here's this old school versus new school thinking is where my head was going. The original engagement definition is defined as rational commitment over emotional commitment to drive discretionary effort. What has happened along the way as practitioners, I think we've leaned hard into rational over emotional to drive intent to stay, which is actually a rational way of thinking about it. It's intent to stay. Would you recommend? Are you satisfied? Which is tied to turnover. And am I having a happy culture? There's where as practitioners, we've really leaned hard. Now, here's the so what. I believe to move a business, it's tied to performance. Here's the bet we're making. Performance is tied to energy in motion. And I think of that as emotion. It is that energy that has direction. That is performance. So the idea was, what if we actually flip the equation or the fraction? And now it's emotion over rational. If you know your math, you know I'm a math guy. The smaller your denominator, the bigger the fraction. Can we get this idea of energy and motion, which now I'm saying that's belonging. The belonging is the unlock there. It is to discretionary effort. So here's the simple math. Define the drivers, activate the actual leader and employee actions, and then track the performance curve. The bet here, a store where people feel valued, heard, stretched, equates to higher sales. That is what we're going after.
And last but not least, in episode 167, What CEOs Want from CHROs and HR, Jennifer Wilson and Brad Warga, partners and global co-heads of the Human Resources Officers Practice at Heidrick & Struggles, share insights from recruiting CHROs at the world's biggest companies. They discuss the most dramatic shifts they've seen in what CEOs are looking for in their CHROs over the past few years, and their insights on where the profession is headed. Jennifer, we start with you. Let's start with the big picture. You and Brad recruit CHROs at the highest levels. What's been the most dramatic shift you've seen from CEOs and what they're looking for from CHROs over the past few years?
The two words we hear most often from CEOs are one, transformational, and two, consigliere. CEOs want partners who can see around corners, guide the ELT and organization through this immense amount of change that we're all dealing with. And they want CHROs who can build the leadership framework that delivers that. We hear less about the technical skills of HR per se and near-term problem solving. Obviously, compensation, talent, succession planning come up as core skills. But what we hear from CEOs is more about the ability to shape the strategy along with them through the people and culture lens.
I agree with everything you said. I think past experience and the playbooks of the past are not as relevant as they used to be. We constantly hear the need for first principled thinking, and people ask, what does that mean? It's really someone who's a creative problem solver, someone who's intellectually curious, someone who's data driven and agile. That really stems from CEOs needing someone who can design new programs based on the business goals. You have to be operationally excellent, but we're really seeing so much change and so much transformation, as Jennifer mentioned, that you have to be strategic at the same time. I'd say we also see a request for business people first, HR second. So that shows up in tons of requests from CEOs for MBA grads with early careers in strategy consulting, technology, or finance, non-traditional HR backgrounds. People that speak the language of business can be equal business stature with every other member of the C-suite. Someone who's trusted, mature, and an unemotional partner who really brings a balance of business strategy, business acumen, and empathy. More and more, these leaders have to have the confidence to speak the truth, but doing so, someone who is an accountable owner of the business. Those are just some examples of what we're hearing from CEOs.
Well, that wraps up what was an amazing 2025 for the Future of HR podcast. I'm looking forward to an even better 2026 and continuing my mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders, one conversation at a time. Thank you for your support and being part of our community.